Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Guys, welcome to the last session of a mega intense weekend. For those people who've been here Saturday and Sunday, are a mega day for those people who've just been here today. It's 5 o'clock and the old body and the brain will be wilting a bit, but I've got the best of surprises because I have four intellectual giants and exciting, interesting giants who are going to wake you all up and get you fizzing again with questions, with questions and ideas. And is the curriculum white? Too white? Should we decolonize it? Are our young people getting taught little more than the history of dead white men? Male steel white men? ? Should Rhodes fall, the statue, or should he stay? Should all our history departments, like my history department in North London this very week, be having reviews in order to make their curriculum more black? Higher black representation? Who should decide the canon? Which bits of history should we friggin' teach? How do we work that out? There's just a few of the potential questions that might come up. And then again, none of them might come up. And so you can ask them from the floor. And I'm Kevin Rooney, and I'm a history teacher, and I'm a member of the Academy of Ideas Education Forum. And if you find the debate interesting in any respect, and your interest in education, feel free to see us at the end, and we'll tell you about the Academy of Ideas Education Forum, and you can sign up. We do online and real physical debates on education about once every 6 weeks with interesting people. So we got four people on the platform, and I'll introduce them to our debate called History Wars in the order in which they're going to speak. So first of all, on my right, we have Nicholas Kinlock. And Nicholas is a history teacher. He's a fellow of SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. He's an honorary fellow of the Historical Association. He's an author. In Defense of Teaching History is his text. And then on my immediate right, we've got Sean Lang, a good friend of the Battle of Ideas, comes often and speaks. He's a senior lecturer in history and a fellow of the Historical Association, and also an author of First World War for Dummies. And then on my left, immediate left, we got Alka Siegel Cuthbert, and Alka's the head of education and the co-coordinator of Don't Divide Us, and she's also an author of What Should Schools Teach? So very appropriate for today. And on my extreme left, we've got Sean Walsh. He's a teacher, head of history at Queen's School Hearts. And then there's a gap. He's not an author. He's like the sad man of the panel. He's just a history teacher. That's all. I wind him up. He's a very good friend of mine, of course.
He won't be now.
Hard pressed history teacher. He's going to go home tonight when everybody chills out the glass of wine, and he's going to start to write his tomb, the thing, book by Sean. Right, guys, without further ado, each speaker will probably have five minutes, and I'll be relatively strict on the timing. And then when they finish, I might ask them a wee question or two, but if you sort of indicate to me that you're down to ask a question, I might not even ask a question and go straight out to the floor instead, if I can pick up the vibes from you, the audience, that you want to come straight in. So, Nicholas, whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I thought I'd start with a story, and no doubt some of you, if not many of you, have heard it before. I can assure you, I used to be a history teacher, that the fact that you've heard it before won't stop me telling you again. And it's, of course, about the Sunday school teacher who arrives at Sunday school one morning and says to her class, "Well, children, as I was cycling in this morning, I saw the most dear little creature in the trees. It had a long, fluffy tail and big ears and bright, beady eyes and was eating a hazelnut. What do you think it was, children?" And a weary voice from the back says, "I don't know, miss, but it's bound to be Jesus." And I'm beginning, in the various times I spend in schools and colleges these days, to get a terrible feeling that if you ask sort of students about their history experience, it tends increasingly to focus on race and racism. It's their version of Jesus. And like Jesus, who was, you know, undeniably an important figure, I can't help believing that race and racism are important, but whether they should be quite as important as they are becoming is another question. Here's another story. A friend of mine who's an educational consultant quite recently visited a school in London to talk about and discuss the history curriculum with their department. The department was very pleased with itself because it had decolonized the curriculum, which is the go-to place at the moment. And they told my friend that they were very pleased. They now spent a term and a half on the slave trade, three lessons on the Tudors. My friend, I think controlling his reaction somewhat, asked a carefully selected group of children what they thought about this, really. First of all, did they know of any other societies in which slavery had existed? No, they didn't really think so. One child, remembering primary school, thought the Romans might have had slaves, but that was about it. What did they know about the Tudors in the three lessons that they'd had? Oh, they were very quick on that one. Henry VIII had a black trumpeter. And that was about it. Now, I don't want to sort of caricature things too much, and I repeat, for the benefit of anyone who thinks I'm, you know, a sort of self-hating race traitor, that I have every view that the curriculum should be as wide and diverse as it, and include as many elements of this fascinating human story as possible. I don't want it all to be white and pale and male and stale. But I think we ought to be really clear about what's going on here. It is a war, and sides have been taken. And what is going on is that decolonization, as opposed to diversification, doesn't just mean that a few more interesting parts of the world are studied than used to be the case. It does actually mean a sort of pretty whole-scale attack on most elements of Western civilization. As one young trainee teacher said to me quite recently when I said, had she ever done anything on Gladstone and Disraeli? Gladstone? Racist, wasn't he? That was all she knew about him. I couldn't help feeling that I was quite glad that no child of mine was being taught by her, but I didn't say so, of course, because I'm nice. Where are we going? I'd really like to tell you that I've got lots and lots of solutions, but I don't really. I think things are going to get rather worse before they get better. I sometimes hope that it's just a sort of fad which a lot of history teachers are signing up to because they like to be thought progressive. But fads, as Sean and I, we used to work together, know well, can last a very, very long time indeed in education. And I think this may well do so. Perhaps my fellow panellists will have better ideas than I have about how some of this stuff is to be combated. So I'm going to finish by just reminding you of what I really believe. It's a war, and you're in it.
Thank you very much. Nicholas, your timing was to perfection. Exactly 5 minutes. Sean, beat that.
I think what a lot of people outside history don't always realise is that the purpose of history has changed and changed a lot over time. So when you have people saying, why isn't this in the curriculum? Why wasn't I taught about that? And so on. They're very often not realising that, well, that sort of reflects changed priorities. I mean, for example, back in Victorian times, the idea of teaching history was to explain why it was that Britain had developed into such a powerful nation and why its institutions were seen to be so good and so on. And that's why you had an emphasis upon the development of Parliament and kings and battles. And more recently, the, you know, history has been there to develop and outline the development of working class or female emancipation or female consciousness and so on in the 20th century. The purpose changes. And moreover, as that changes, also old narratives are replaced by new ones. That's absolutely normal. Indeed, it's healthy. It's what history is about. And a good example would be the changing narrative on the slave trade. For many years, the sort of thing that I learned at school was that the 18th century Britain was a rather beautiful place and very elegant. But on the side, there was this dreadful slaving going on in Bristol and in Liverpool, and you learned about that, and you learned a lot of detail about what went on. What's happened more recently is that there's much more awareness of just how far into British society and how extensively it involves people, and that it wasn't just a few people on the edge, and that, you know, it was a very, very big thing, and all sorts of people either involved directly, investing in it, or working in areas of work that depended upon it. Now we've got a new picture. That's fine. Indeed, it's right, because the evidence shows it, and, you know, there's nothing wrong there. That's not a war. But what happens now, I think, is that it's not just producing a new narrative. There's a sort of targeted trashing and a selective outrage. And that's what the sort of conflict that Nicholas is talking about. And it's not really interested in presenting simply a new narrative supported by evidence. It's about proving a particular, normally political agenda. Race is one of the main ones. It's not the only one, but it is certainly a central one. And a good example of this was an event which took place last year, I think, at Churchill College, Cambridge, where I'm on the committee of the archive, the Churchill Archive there. And it's an event organised by the archive. And they had a panel of people looking at Churchill. And the whole event, which I think you can see on YouTube, was a sort of trashing of Churchill in terms of Churchill was a racist. And there was no sort of engagement with anything else. And even to the point where his role in the war, which you might have thought was quite relevant to his reputation, was sort of laughed at, because, after all, he can't have been that great a war leader, can he? Because I don't seem to recall him leading any armies into battle. And you thought, what's happened to discourse? This was Churchill College, Cambridge, for heaven's sake. And the college was very concerned, because they felt quite rightly that their reputation had been called into question. But when they tried to sort of respond to this, they were accused of, guess what, being racist. So, in a sense, what we've got is a discourse which isn't interested in nuance, is only interested in one, you know, in one particular aspect. And it's as if the purpose of history has now become to impart moral lessons. I don't believe the purpose of history is to impart moral lessons. You can derive moral lessons from history, we all do, but it's not the purpose of teaching it, and it should never be the purpose of putting it across. Because morality goes for good, bad, evil, saintly, whatever. Whereas history demands judgment, it demands nuance, it demands balance, and that doesn't fit very well. So when you do have your heroes and heroines, and the trouble with statues are coming, the trouble with statues is that you do, you know, put someone on a pedestal, and be very careful, because you can have someone who you think is your sort of hero or heroine, Murray Stopes, the pioneer of birth control, a firm believer in eugenics, and that's why she wanted birth control. And then you suddenly think, hang on a minute, I didn't know that. Martin Luther King, I'm not going to completely knock his reputation, but a plagiarist of his PhD thesis, something of a serial womanizer, and you will always find, if this is what history does, it will always provide you with those nuances, not necessarily very welcome ones, but that's the subject, that's the discipline. And the discipline is taking all of that into account in order to reach a balanced judgment. But you can't do that if you're not interested in any of that, or if you just latch onto one aspect. Gladstone's slavery thing was that his family made their fortune from slavery, and as a young man, he spoke in defence of the slave trade, and then spent the rest of his life as a sort of anti-imperialist liberal. He's a highly complex man. But that's what I mean. You latch onto one little aspect, and that becomes the whole judgment. That's not history. And it's the sort of pushback against that, which I think is what the history wars consist of. Statues always come up and come down. Alex von Tonsemann's just done a very good book about it. But I don't want just images around me of good people. I want the whole of it. I want to see images of people that I might not approve of. I want to know the full richness of the past of the country I live in. And if I see it around me, all the better. So I don't, you know, by all means put plaques up, by all means put explanations up, by all means put extra statues up if you must. But I don't want to see an erasure going on. I want to see the whole picture, warts and all.
Fantastic, really good.
How's that timing?
Perfect timing, brilliant speech, really interesting. And I'll go over to yourself.
Thank you. There's a group called Justice to History, which are a group of history teachers. I'm sure Sean, you, Nicholas probably, everyone has heard of them. They're endorsed by the School History Project, which is quite a respectable professional body. And they recently held a series of training events for teachers. And one of the slides said, our history classrooms could be the places where a reckoning can still take place. A reckoning can still take place in a classroom. That kind of got me wondering. This suggests that the history war isn't about the past itself, but it's about whose version of the past is legitimised and whose is discredited. So we've got, I think, two things going on here, which are kind of very following on from what Nicholas and Sean have said, and perhaps repeating some of the points, but it's a battle for epistemic authority, whose interpretation of historical facts count. And more importantly, I think perhaps today in the context of a broader politics of identity, there's a battle for moral authority over which values will count. And I just want to give one, really all I want to do is give you an example of that illustrates how the anti-educational features of this. And also it's not, you know, we're talking about it pushing a moral agenda. And I have thought that, and I still think that to a bit, and I still might say it. But actually, I don't actually think it is really a moral agenda. It's actually something quite anti-moral. It's pushing conformism, okay? And I hope to sort of explain that. You see, so let's just take this example of public statues. So we have, as you know, Sean said, we've got, you know, different interpretations are part of developing history. Well, one interpretation is that these are statues that were either erected in former times of slave trading, or they were put up later, subsequently, by people who wanted to celebrate something about that time or those people who were also involved in the slave trade. And therefore, the argument goes, their continued presence, unless it's explained away with a contextual plaque or something, is continuing to endorse a morally repugnant system. And it also perpetuates the effects of original violence of slavery. And I think, apart from just like being wrong, I think this interpretation. It's wrong because it relativizes and minimizes, one thing is it relativizes and minimizes the full political and ethical horrors of slavery. You know, it means that slavery it makes slavery into this all-encompassing thing that has totalizing power, and it has the authority to do two things. It can, by mentioning slavery, somehow you can explain everything that's happened between then and now, everything that's happening today. Is not a result of the specifics of, you know, political parties or geopolitics or internal politics or individual agency. It's a result of some event that somehow has this almost mystical power, you know, sort of plucked from the past, slavery or colonialism. And it all goes back to then. So all that huge history in between, like, you know, two world wars, the Cold War, the development of first, second and third worlds, all of that is kind of removed from view. So I think it collapses historical specificity. It's a negative knowledge effect. More importantly, it asserts, but it doesn't win, it asserts a moral authority with which to kind of legitimise and delegitimise value. So what's at stake is it's not a battle over whether slavery is acceptable or not. Nobody thinks it's acceptable. But it's a battle over values, and it's the values in particular are those of freedom and of tolerance. because I think, you know, there's what it's denying is the freedom for people to look at the different interpretations and think through and decide for themselves. And often this is comes along with a zero tolerance tag. You know, we will not tolerate any racism, any deviance from that particular view. And now I think an alternative viewpoint, which you'll find, is one where I think Sean began to, you know, you want to see the fullness of things, right? And you just look at the statues in London today. Just walking here, you will have gone past a statue of Gandhi, a statue of Robert Peel, a statue of Millicent Fawcett, a statue of all sorts of people. So you can see Oliver Cromwell, a regicide Republican, a gory conqueror of Ireland, you know, which the statue was paid for and unveiled by Lord Rosebery, who was a former Liberal Prime Minister. And this stands opposite a bust of Charles I, who was his victim, right? So you've kind of got, in Oxford, you've got statues of Catholic cardinals, Cardinal Allen and Cardinal Newman, who were regarded as traitors when the Oriel College was built. But today it seemed acceptable to have them on display. You also have very nearby a martyr's memorial of three Protestant bishops. So in St. James's Park, we can see a statue of Clive near Pall Mall, a statue of Clive of India, near a modern commemoration of 200 plus victims of the terrorist bombing in Bali in 2002. And I think these juxtapositions are fantastic, right? Because they prompt a curiosity, right? Or they should do. And school should be encouraging that. Any history teacher should be encouraging that curiosity and the kind of tools with which you develop that curiosity and interrogate it yourself, interrogate your own initial reactions. Because, you know, I mean, we want citizens who can freely speculate and imagine, right? Or does everything in our material environment, does everything, every textbook in our schools, every PowerPoint, have to direct us to this single predetermined narrative and the concomitant fake values of zero tolerance and emotional safety? Right? I think this is this conformism that we can see. And what is at stake here in the history wars? It's really, at stake is, do we believe in enlightenment values of tolerance and freedom? These are the values. You know, people say, somebody in the last session said, yes, but there were slaves when they developed this. Kant, who I love, Kant, Elko, don't you know Kant was a rabid racist? And he was you know, some of his writings were racist, but they weren't racist in the sense we mean today. They say horrible things about black people. He also wrote The Critique of Moral Reasoning, after which he wrote Towards Perpetual Peace and Cosmopolitanism, in which if you read it, it changes his views. And that is the thing about Enlightenment thinking and values. Through reasoning, we can reflect and revise and change. And if we rule that out, we do have conformism.
Thanks, Alka. Thank you very much. And Sean, yourself.
Thanks, Kevin. As he pointed out earlier, I do feel a bit underqualified to be on the panel, so bear with me as I go through this. As a true millennial, I'm going to be reading my speech off my phone. I'm not scrolling through Instagram and just moving on to my next point. So, talks of decolonising the curriculum have been met with praise and scorn, and there are those that believe that history in schools is certainly too white, too male and too pale. And while the first two seem to be based on some sort of identity crisis within the UK or arguably too much soft power influence from the US, the idea that history is stale or boring is just categorically false, so I won't be debating that. The other issues, white and male, is assuming why we're all in the room. And the idea of playing identity politics within the classroom is a common fear I've come across in my reading on this, and it's a common fear on the panel, as I'm sure it is with you. And I find that fear of identity politics interesting because, as a history teacher and my love of history, it has shaped my identity and my relationship with history. So growing up in the Republic, or as Kevin would say, the Free State, or as my colleagues or as my colleagues in work would say, Southern Ireland, we all clearly have a different relationship with history and a different identity of history. And when I left secondary school, I probably had a very large post-colonial chip on my shoulder. Whether that's right or wrong, it's just true. And we Irish arguably put too much pride in our stalwart opposition to British rule. And we sort of end up as this post-colonial nation that has done no wrong, this sort of good guy, bad guy narrative, when in actual fact, we had a fascist party. We were the only country in the world to send condolences to Nazi Germany when Hitler died. We were involved in the partition of our own country. They are all things that I found difficult with my identity and my relationship with history, because I wasn't taught it, and my identity was shaped as a result. So I'm going to rattle off some names here from Irish history, and you'll recognise most, but you might not recognise all. So we'll start with the easy ones. Cromwell, Henry VIII, Lloyd George. Okay. Strongbow, Wolfetone, James Connolly. Now, every single one of those is pivotal in our history, but they did serve to create the narrative of, essentially, occupation and resistance to the Brits. So I'm sure there's many on this panel that would rightly correct me that's an oversimplified narrative. And I would argue the same can be said for English history. We cover the Tudors. We cover the Great Fire of London. We cover the Civil War and Hastings. And I wouldn't change any of that. They're all pivotal moments in English history. But do they serve to create a rose-tinted view of that history like I had? So with that being said, and the phrase that's come up many times is decolonize the curriculum. Why is that phrase so abhorrent? What are we actually afraid of? I mean, if we heard today that another country colonized another, we'd all be, well, shocked, because we know what colonization involves. So again, chip on my shoulder, the British Empire was not great. There is no empire in history that was great. They were all built on the backs of exploiting and oppressing a specific group of people. Participation in the transatlantic slave trade, exploitation during the Industrial Revolution, the Indian-Irish famines, all exacerbated by imperialist policies. But these atrocities are also guilty of Spain, Portugal, France, Germany, the Mongolian Empire, the Japanese Empire, the Roman Empire. All of these things are true. And we need to see all of history, not just our narrative of history, which is why I think there's a lot of opposition to this. Are we worried about our own relationship with history, our own identity with it? Are we sort of taking on something that we shouldn't be taking on and just seeing history for what it is? Why can't Drake be an explorer, a fantastic naval strategist, and a slave trader? The idea that we remove key individuals from the curriculum, well, according to Nicholas now it's not, but I thought it was a nonsense. Like, if somebody came to me and told me to change my curriculum to make it more diverse, my response would be, why? But secondly, it wouldn't mean that I would remove the Tudors. It wouldn't mean that I would remove Hastings. I wouldn't remove learning about William the Conqueror. He shaped this country forever. So sort of to summarize, what we need is to avoid this perspective of tokenistic gestures that just end up in political goal scoring in the future. Instead, why can't we encourage students to genuinely critique history? So why can't they learn about World War I and imperialism? Why can't they learn about the suffragettes and the Stonewall movement? Why not the Industrial Revolution and its ties to slavery? And if you'd allow me one more pedantic question, do we or do we not want critical thinkers?
Okay. Here we go. Okay. I'm just seriously processing a couple of things. I see lots of hands. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to strike a balance with you. I'm going to ask each question, but they don't have to answer it. I'll go straight out to you, and then I'll take a few from you, and then they can answer my question if they want, along with yours. So here's my question for you, Nicholas. And sorry, guys, you'll think some of these questions are silly and naive, but I want to ask them nonetheless. Maybe I'm devil's advocate, I don't know. But the first question is, how many teachers know there's a war? You come to the Battle of Ideas, and you're all into the culture war and all the rest of it. You come into your school on Monday morning and you find a lot of your colleagues don't have a clue. Might be different universities. So that's a serious question, right? How many know that they're in the midst of a war? Just about yourself, Sean Lang, might be a bit specific, this question, but what I want you to try to work through for me is when you look at, everybody calls it Black Lives Matter, critical race theory, that's an awful lot of the cultural discussions around that. But to what extent do, say, just young people or people who want the curriculum changed have a point in that they think that the British history curriculum for a long time has been one-sided and rose-tinted? I mean, you talk about the Churchill. You talk about the Churchill conference. Was that Cambridge or Oxford?
Cambridge.
Right, in Cambridge. When you were this is the 100th birthday of something. You might wish it a happy birthday, or a get stuffed birthday. It's 100th birthday of Northern Ireland, the creation of partition. Right. Yeah. Right now, but Churchill sent in the Black and Tans. He was behind the whole idea of the Black and Tans. He knew what he was doing. They were to terrorise the population. But he also armed the UVF, turned them into the specials in the police force. He was told in the House of Commons by Joe Devlin, the MP, if you do that, Calic's blood will spill, and a lot of it spilled. Mm. How many frigging people in England even know that? And then how many people could tell you even one sentence about the Belfast pogroms? Mm. Where hundreds and hundreds of Calics were massacred. And all of those things you can point to a large extent, Churchill, to a large extent, he knew. So my point is, do we need to just hold back a wee bit sometimes and maybe try to understand why people might want to stick the boot into somebody like Churchill, is my question. And Alka, your speech was so brilliant. I was desperately trying to process it, and it'll take a few seconds for points to sink in. But my question to you is, who's doing the pushing? I mean, this is an impossible question, but if you had about 1 minute to come back to the audience, how does this work? Right, a black guy gets killed in America, something comes across the Atlantic to Britain, bang, we're in the midst of a culture war, you get an ordinary school staffroom in a classroom. How does this, you know, I struggle and I actually follow the culture, I actually follow this and I still struggle. Somebody asked me, I don't think I could really explain it. So I'm curious about how that works its way through. And I'm going to say something almost blasphemous. Maybe the reason why I'm curious is because I don't think the culture war is there to the extent that maybe some people are suggesting. Now, I'm being slightly devil's advocate there. I don't know myself. And then, Sean, when you say, by the way, the condolences to Hitler, a great question would be, what was wrong with that? Ireland was a neutral nation, by the way, incidentally, and the protocol was that that's what you did when a head of state died. So, you know, in the revisionist wars in Ireland, a lot of anti-republicans and pro-unionists use that as a big problem. I don't see the problem, but if anybody in the audience wants to pick that up, I'm happy for them to run with that. But that's a bit specific with us Irish teachers on the panel, so I won't dwell on that. The thing about, you can learn about both. Are you potentially setting up a straw man to knock it down? Would you not think that a lot of teachers do teach about both? Funny you should talk about Drake. I remember just a couple of weeks before the summer, this is precisely what I was doing about him being a good navigator, and a slave trader, and a colonialist and all the rest of it. So don't you think your fellow teachers tend to do that or not? So those are my thinking out loud questions for you, and you're allowed to ignore them if you want, and I'm being honest. So I'll go to the teacher at the back, and then I'll come up here to, I think it's Alex, I see. We'll take those four.
I wanted to question the neutrality of statues. So everyone on the panel seems to take the historical perspective of conservationism, so approaching history as something to be recorded in all its factual detail, rather than one to cast a narrative. And in that, I wanted to ask about statues, because presumably if the goal was merely to wipe out these parts of history that are being over-focused on, museums would be attacked just as much as well. But for my money, it seems to be statues specifically. And so I wanted to ask why, in particular with the dichotomy between those two statues. Because even though you're representing both views, a statue isn't a neutral depiction, or at least I think so, because they are always designed with praising the person in question in mind? Well, almost always. You don't put up statues of your enemies, generally. And therefore, even if you do have that dichotomy, is it really fair? Because for my mind, it's one positive representation of one side and one positive of the other. And that's not the same thing on a historical question like slavery. There's only one right answer. So though I support, you know, bringing history into the public sphere, are statues a neutral affair? And can we try and make them so? Are counter plaques a good option for that? Do they do the function? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I think to answer your question, you were saying, you know, what's wrong with doing both? You know, it happens anyway, I think. I used to teach history, and people these days talk as though there's no black history in the curriculum. We've now got to put it in there. It's been there for a long time, and a lot of detail has been about it, warts and all. So I don't think it's true to say it never existed, now we've got to have it. And I think the real issue is this one. History should be a subject that helps you think, teaches you the ability to think, not what to think. And I think the decolonisation is about what to think, and I think that's a huge problem. There was a conference that my union ran, and one of the main speakers was not my favourite, Kehinde Andrews, but another one said the idea of decolonisation is to strip whiteness out of history, strip racism out of history. And Kehinde Andrews said it's to recolonise it. So he wants to just impose a black version of history on it, according to him. Now, I think that's a terrible idea. Now, I think because there was inequality in the past and slavery, it doesn't mean that somehow it hangs over us like a ghost from the past and means that black kids today can't achieve. But I think the way it's being set out, it's actually saying that in many cases, and I think that's a terrible, terrible message to give. And I hate the idea, that we're just going to replace it with standpoint epistemology. So, you know, if you come from a certain group, your view is worth a lot more than it is from another. No, I think you should teach the parts of history which changed the world, which are fundamental to change, and you mentioned some of them, which are really important, and how to think about that. There's loads of things you can do with it, but you shouldn't be teaching some morality that whiteness is bad and it's got to be replaced with victim standpoint epistemology.
Thanks very much.
Again, there are lots of history teachers on the panel, and I'm sure there are some in the room as well. As a history teacher myself, I'm proud in this country too that we have a relatively rich forum for talking about teaching history in the Historical Association. Now, I know that the general average political views of people in the Historical Association are somewhere on the left, but I was wondering, where are they in this debate, and have you engaged with them at all as to this particular question that we're discussing this afternoon?
Great question, actually. And we've got that fellow with the receding hairline at the front and the stripey shirt that coming up here. He goes by the name of Alex, I believe.
I wish I had a receding hairline. I think there's two things I bring to this. I'm interested in history or the reading around this discussion. Not a history teacher by any stretch, but two things I think are important are, one, we have to end this discussion because it's that important. We have to make a distinction between academics and the academic discussion of history and how history is taught in state schools. As an example, I went to a state school, only two things I remember probably for the whole of school, is the slave trade and the American Civil War. And I went to school in Glasgow. So at that level, and so this is, I hope, relevant to the second thing I think you have to bring to this subject, and that is the classic question, what is history? Because history's not just facts, is it? History, and what ends up a canonical part of history, is the thing that we agree his mass impact. Doesn't he have a massive impact on your lives? It's probably not that important then. So this is, Sean, is it?
Yep.
Your point about, you know, kings and queens. Why do we teach about kings and queens in the UK? Because the way society was organised in that time, that's where the impact was made on people's lives. So again, if you look at how history is taught in schools, it's probably, as Kevin points out, it's unsurprising that many history teachers kind of say, where's this all coming from? You know, because they're teaching at a good level and they're teaching about the most important, impactful things in history. Whereas the discussions we are having at this level, I think, is more about how we approach history and what is history is for in terms of understanding society.
Great. All interesting questions and points from the floor. Thanks for that, Alex. And guys, pick up what you want. If you don't mind me asking, don't be too long. And then I'm going to go straight back out because I see a lot of hands already. So we can go whatever way you want. Do you want to kick off, Nicholas?
I'm happy to.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just take 2 points, really, from the many that have been raised well. And I'll take yours, actually. You know, how many teachers know there's a culture war? Well, probably not a lot. I don't think I thought about it when I was doing it 5 days a week. I don't think I went in to see 3B on a Monday morning thinking another blow for the culture war here. So probably not a lot, but it doesn't mean it isn't happening. I think many wars, like the Cold War, are all the more intense for not being consciously thought about very much of the time. Well, what I'd really like to take your point about statues, and I think because I think you made lots and lots of really good points, and I don't know that I've got an answer to your various questions, but I've just got some responses of which are just how I feel. I mean, my principal feeling, which isn't I think shared with anybody else I know, is that in Britain there are just too many statues.
Yes,
and personally, if it hadn't become so politicised, I would have been absolutely delighted if 90% of them had been removed. I wouldn't be now, because each one represents some sort of symbol and battle. But in practice, it wouldn't bother me at all if most of them went. I mean, until other people started pointing them out to me, I barely noticed most of them, except to say how hideous they were. Even somebody who likes to think he knows a lot about history, they didn't mean very much. I mean, God forbid that I should agree with Ken Livingstone on anything. But when he said that there wasn't now much point in having a statue of General Havelock in Trafalgar Square, I couldn't agree more. You know, we used to have General Gordon, by the way, in Trafalgar Square, and he got moved during the war to a less august place on the embankment. And, you know, the only person on the planet who complained about that was Winston Churchill. In other words, you know, I tend to think, personally, that we make too much of statues, and if we made a little less of them, we could actually get rid of almost all of them. And I'll finish with this. If it was left to me, and thank God it isn't, if it was left to me, I would replace statues. I wouldn't put up any new ones, personally. But if I had to, they'd be made of something friable and perishable, like balsa wood. So that after a natural interval, when the deep-seated, you know, negatives of this person inevitably came to light, the thing would already have rotted away to nothing. And that's how I deal with it. But I don't suppose it'll happen.
Interesting. Sean.
I want to deal with 2 points, and I'm sorry about this, because it's one thing you said about slavery. You said there's only one right answer, and I know what you mean. But what is really worrying me about the whole terms of this debate is that we assume a moral superiority for ourselves. And the whole idea of a decolonized curriculum is that what has existed is in some way wrong, and we know better. And I don't think we do. If you take the slavery issue, There are something like 10 million people in slavery today. Yes. A quarter of them are children. Slavery exists in every corner of the globe and every part of this country. I was saying this to a school in Hertfordshire just recently, actually, on Thursday, making this point, that if you're going to start sort of pointing the finger, don't for one moment think that you are in any position to do so. Every society that I can think of, there may be some exceptions, someone here might have one, but pretty much every society I can think of has run on slavery, including our own. They may call it different things. It may not technically be slavery if there is a wage involved, but it is slavery in effect. And that's what worries me, because the certainty and the confidence, the moral certainty with which I hear is, ironically, exactly that of the 19th century colonialists with regard to other cultures. And who did indeed topple statues and deliberately sort of, as it were, offend the local gods. There's an issue which is implicit, and this is the second one which hasn't actually been mentioned, which is curriculum time. Because every time you say, why don't people know about this, why don't people know about that, entirely fair questions. But you're trying to cram in a huge amount into what for most schools is, and secondary schools we're talking about here, at 3 years for all pupils at most, because obviously you can give it up, you don't have to do it to GCSE, and in practice often 2 years. Now, the last time I was in this building was about 20 years ago as Honorary Secretary of the Historical Association, chairing a big public debate as part of a campaign to get history compulsory to 16. And one of the reasons that we were pushing it was precisely because there are so many important issues that we want to deal with. You raised the issue about Churchill and why can't we look? I've never known any history teacher who wouldn't welcome the chance to do that. But you can't, given the amount of curriculum time that teachers actually have. And that's a reality which has to temper any of our debates. And this is why I'm entirely in favour of adding things in, but I'm very conscious that you're adding more and more into a very, very constricted time.
Thanks, Sean. I'll go yourself.
Thank you. Sean, I was going to answer on the statues, but you've kind of covered it, but just quickly to say, I don't really think that right and wrong are historical judgments, they're moral judgments. And so when you say there's only one answer possible, that worries me slightly, because even if you're talking about slavery or the Bengal famine or Churchill or whatever horrible thing, it's not that there's sort of one answer, it's just that there's more than one question, right? There are lots of questions, and the causation in history is always going to be multivariate and interacting, and so it's more complex. Just on the your question, why, Kevin? I mean, I could talk for ages about it. I won't. I will just say, if you haven't heard, just look up Nadeem Zahawi's comments today to the National Association of Head Leaders School Leadership. He said, education is we don't have enough black head teachers, education and schools must reflect their community and pupils. And I'm sure that's a phrase that sounds quite benign, and we're probably, anyone working in education will hear it all the time. And I think it's just one of the most educationally bankrupt statements I've ever heard, right? Because what happened to extending knowledge? What happened to getting people to inquire into their own values as well as the values of others? Because values come into education as well. But no, it's just reflect. It's become a trope, and it links into the question you said: why do people know that there's a war? Because a war, you usually have two clear sides, and I don't think we have quite got that situation yet. There aren't two clear sides, but it certainly the discussions feel very hostile and like a war at times. And just very finally, quickly on selection of content curriculum, because it is limited, we have to decide. And I have a genuine problem here, especially with history, because I've always thought national boundaries don't really count with knowledge. It's what's good knowledge and what is bad knowledge. But that's kind of a kind of high, abstract, very general level. But we're in a national, we live in a society that has a nation. We have a pluralism of people in our nation. And if there isn't a kind of agreed identity or story or narrative, what are people going to be integrating into? So I'm beginning to change, shift, or soften my position on that a bit, and think, but it has to be publicly decided as far as possible.
Brilliant. Before we go to you, Sean, and go out, I'm going to ask a question, but I don't want you to ask. It's about what you said. I want someone in the audience to pick it up and run with it. See the Nadine Sahari point that you just referenced there about we need more black teachers, head teachers, and you said, you know, God's sake, what a poor understanding of what education. It doesn't matter if you're a white teacher, whatever, whatever, whatever. I sort of completely get that, and I've said that all my days. But I tell you a true story. Last year, in fact, I'm a liar, it was a year before last year because we had lockdown. I was teaching in Wren Academy in Finchley, and I was teaching a really nice class of year 10 history students. And one of the girls was called Clara. She's a brilliant student, black girl. And she, Christian, really conducted herself so brilliantly. Everything about her, just pleasure to teach. And she her work was great. She's head for an A star, but she rarely spoke. She was quiet. But we get into discussion with the students about this, about black teachers. And it was actually, it moved from that to black figures in the novels and so on. And she put her hand up to speak. I couldn't believe it was so rare. And she said, sir, sometimes it's just nice to see yourself reflected. And she was the nicest, quietest black girl when she said it. And it's sort of like, because I'm so used to being combative and go, who cares what the color of your skin is? When you heard it from a young black kid like that, I have to say, it did get me thinking a bit. And I'm going to leave it with the audience if anybody wants to pick that up. And basically, well, you can make that point you make, and it's sort of right politically. In the real world, at the coalface, if you're teaching a load of kids, mightn't it be a really good idea if there's a few black teachers or a few black figures in the novel, whatever you're teaching, whatever group of kids? Anyway, I'll just go leave it out there. Feel free to knock me down or whatever.
Yeah, in terms of the statues, I wholeheartedly agree with what Nicholas said. I mean, it's going to sound callous, but I really couldn't care less on that issue. On the revisionist wars and the strawman argument, you sort of proved my point, Kev, because that's your relationship with history. That's your identity with history. That fired you up immediately because I said something that bothered you with that thing. And that's what I'm talking about with these sort of culture wars. And the bigger question was, is there such a culture war? And what I was trying to get to is sort of like, are we being overly sensitive to criticism? And I don't mean criticism of us, but it feels like criticism of us because we followed our history. And now all of a sudden people are calling for changes to our history. And that being said, as I said in my speech, I wouldn't change the fundamental moments in English history whatsoever. All I'm saying is that, and in terms of the curriculum time, I'm well aware of that. And sort of pressures to redesign the curriculum as well, I'm well aware of that. But unfortunately, as you pointed out, you said history teachers teach all this other stuff. That's not been my case with trainee teachers coming through. They come through with a certain narrative, and that narrative has now switched to what we're worried about. And there's sort of this sort of heavy critique of everything that is sort of English or British, if you're sensitive about it. And sort of what I'm trying to get to is that why can't we keep things as nuanced as this discussion has been?
Spot on, mate. Okay, let's go out. Panel, sit back, relax, watch the audience for a while, or listen to the audience. I'll take, for example, yourself, and then I'll take yourself off that, and then I'll take two from the back. We'll wait for the microphone to come, this one with a flurry blouse at the front. Is it flurry? Sorry. Forgive me.
Thank you very much to the panel. I have a series of points to make. I'm afraid that there are more statements than questions, but I'd love to hear your reflections on them. However, the first statement I have to make is to the young man who made the point about statues and your assertion that museums are not under attack. You are completely wrong. Museums are very much under attack. Historical archives are very much under attack internally, and so are academic libraries. So this idea that decolonialization... yes, absolutely, okay. Look at the British Museum and the internal wrangling they've had recently about taking down Sir Hans Sloane. Yeah, it's been all over the place. I will give you more examples in a moment, but I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. The idea that decolonialization as a concept is not dangerous, I think, is erroneous. So I'm a trained historian, I'm not a particularly good one, and that's why I moved into the archive sector. So the change for me was when I got to actually handle historical archives, and I said, shit, you know, a lot of the stuff I thought was wrong. Here's the evidence. Wow. And then I got my PhD, and I actually came across historians who are teaching right now at places like King's who said to me, oh, I never go to the archives. Oh, I don't use archives. I don't use evidence like that. Then I got a job in archives. The archives sector takes concepts such as decolonialization, and they whittle that down into the work that they do, and they use that to make selections about what gets digitized and what gets made available and what filters down into those case studies that are used in schools. And this is dangerous. The big companies who are doing the digitization, because most small archives and libraries can't afford to do it, they tap into these trends. They tap into these trends. So now you have big collections of digitized historical archives, which are not necessarily based on the archives themselves, they're thematic. And they're thematic based on what's going on at the moment. In academic libraries, and I will wrap this up pretty soon. Thank you for being patient. I have a lot of experience of working in academic libraries. You would not believe the decisions that are made at a librarianship level, not even by subject specialists, by people who really have no idea what they're talking about, who want to push the curriculum, who take this concept of decolonialization without necessarily knowing even what it means, but just ticking all the boxes. And they actually, I have seen it, they try to infiltrate the curriculum. So this is where concepts like decolonialization, I think, are dangerous. The last point that I wanted to make, and that's feeding off of what Sean has said, both of the Seans, as a matter of fact. So Sean to my left.
We'll call him English Sean.
We'll call him Irish Sean.
I'm not going down that road.
Sean number one, Sean number two.
That one and that one. Right? So Sean number one. Sorry, Sean number two. You're really getting it today. I think you were making a point about having the longer view and having the critical lens. I will come back to that, but Sean, number two, your point about the value of identity politics, I totally take that. Personally, as a historian, that's how I went in. I'm a feminist in recovery. I'm about 5 years clean now. But that's the way I went in. So I absolutely accept that this is a way in for people, particularly when we're talking about young people in the classroom. It's a hook. It's a great hook to get people interested and realise the relevance of history. But if we lose the long view, and if we bombard people with case studies after case studies because we want to represent everyone and everything that's ever happened, that's a danger. Can we please just stick with critical skills, critical appraisal of evidence, and if you set people up with that, if you set young people up with those skills, then they can go off and do the case studies that they want to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your patience.
Now, I really like that contribution, but please don't be as long, because we have about 14 or 15 people. I said that lad with a blue shirt yourself. Did you, your glasses, you? And then I'll go down to the back, and I'll go for the fella in the blue at the back, and then I'll go over there, and I see Eric Kaufman on this side, and I promise, Eric, I'll come over to you.
Thanks. It seems to me that a lot of these discussions originate from the ideas that come from the United States, specifically around statues, but not just with regards to history, in fact, but a lot of culture. To what extent do you think that in the UK we are particularly sort of supine to American ideas when maybe in France they would be more resistant to them or other countries? And related to that, why do you think whoever you think did start the history wars, why did they start them? And what was their goal in mind? I think there's a quote by Orwell saying that in order to destroy a people, you obliterate their past. Is their goal in the United States to sort of to change people's idea about the past and therefore you can change the future? You know, if you tell people that their past was completely wrong, and in a lot of the cases in the US it was, then you can radically change what happens in the future.
Thank you very much. And the guy right at the very back, and then just in front of that fella, there is a fella in the we'll go to you next, and then we're going to come down, and we're going to have 1, 2, 3 females after that, right? 1, 2, 3, right?
I mean, to some extent, what I wanted to say links up with what that guy has just raised, which is, where is this coming from? Well, obviously, it has been influenced by developments coming over from the US, but I think it also is very much about where the professional managerial class in Britain are today, and the fact that history teachers and the History Education Academy is the absolute embodiment of them. That group have lost any interest in class, and they are focused on identity. And they are also influenced by the Brexit vote. They are also influenced by what you might call NOBS, neoliberal order breakdown syndrome. There is a sense of kind of, you know, loss, and this is a way of dealing with it. But to me, how, you know, the radicalism of it is incredibly limited, in the sense that, linking up with what Alk has said about the Justice for History group, one of the people within that has written an amazing article about Jamaica, which I'm sure some of you have read, which is great. But it also links back to some other points that have been made. It is one thing, and it is allowable within the curriculum, to talk about 100 years of Jamaican slavery and then abolition and the Governor Eyre Rebellion, etc., etc. Where is a study of Jamaica post-World War II looking at the influence of the EU, of the IMF, of Michael Manley being thrown out of power in 1974, or 1980, in fact, nowhere. Because what this is about liberalism at home. Liberalism at home wants to be looking inwards without challenging what capitalism does around the world, linking back to what was said about slavery still going on. There's no desire to engage with that. So this is about where the PMC stand today and what their concerns are. And just to finish one final point, you know, who is saying this? What I find most frustrating about it is, yes, there are the woke people who are coming through, who you might call successor ideologists, but many of the people who are actually championing curriculum change, etc., are those who wrote the previous curriculums, are those, you know, who are friends of Nicholas's and Sean's, etc., who have actually created amazing curricula, which have given people the chance to look at things in a nuanced way. You know, all of this patronising stuff about people have never looked at X, Y, and Z, nonsense. It's been there for decades. You know, I remember when I met Nicholas 20 years ago talking about the Holocaust. Amazingly, what I said to him then, if a teacher said that in the classroom today, I'm not sure they'd be allowed to say it, in fact. That's where we are. It's about who those people are and about holding the line and actually saying, being proud of what we've done, the achievements of people like Nicholas. Thank you very much.
And the fellow in front of you, yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a brief point, which was the guy in the pink shirt. You said something about why we need to welcome, or there might be an argument for, you know, revising statues. And you said, you gave the example of Winston Churchill being behind the black and tans and some of the atrocities. I can respect that and I can accept that. What I have a problem with is a lot of the people that I hear about wanting to tear down statues, which are kind of these mobs, but I've seen them on social media and I've seen them interviewed, is they don't understand why they're pulling the statue down. They just say, Winston Churchill was a racist. And you say, why? I say, they don't really know. They're just kind of parroting something. Yeah. I have a problem with that. But if people are actually thinking about it and they've got a reason why and they can link it to something, you know, then that's a proper debate and then you can actually talk about it. That's my point.
But I wouldn't want to take, to be clear, I wouldn't want to take Churchill's statue down in the slightest, by the way. He done a lot of other very good things. Right, there's 4 people. I'm taking jury, our panel, and then I'm coming back to you. I'm going to take... there's another... who was the person I said? Vanessa, and then the lady with a, like, greedy jacket, white blouse, dangling in front of you. Then we zoom over to you, and then we'll squeeze Eric Kaufman in, we'll come back to you, then we'll go back out.
My question is about the relationship of history to political governance. So that it's been highlighted how history was related to the governance of empire. History was also related to the development of parliamentary democracy. So if you take out discussion of the 17th century, it's because you're less interested in the development of parliamentary democracy. When it comes to the 1990s, some of the interest in World War and the Holocaust, you can see how that links to international interventionism and seeing the world in terms of good and evil, and we must, something must be done, we must intervene. So I think it's really interesting to think about the context of decolonising the curriculum and what model of governance underpins it, what vision of governance underpins it. And I think the thing that's really interesting about it, sort of its distinction between the 1990s and good and evil, it's very therapeutic character, its social psychology character. And I think if we trace back the origins of those ideas, ironically, it comes through we can trace it back to colonial anthropology and its relationship to a model of cosmopolitan governance, where you, instead of having political self-determination, you give people cultural recognition. And that's what's been offered in the classroom, is a model of cultural recognition.
Thank you, Vanessa. And we'll pass it on to the woman there. Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that, I've kind of looked at, been to some of the other events, and it's been talking about a climate of fear in terms of COVID and, the environment. And I think that this concept of some culture war that's being had with history is just, it's just fear tactics. There is no war being had. I just think it's just a fallacy that's just being made up. And I can kind of understand how some people could feel that it's a war because, you know, the stories that we've been told, what we know, forms part of our identity. And when that's challenged, that can often feel like you're under attack. Now, that doesn't make that attack real, but I can understand how it could feel that you're under attack. And I guess that, in terms of looking at the curriculum and decolonising it, or whatever you want to call it, is really just about having a more inclusive curriculum for me. It's just about acknowledging that, there are other parts of history that make up British history that aren't included, and it's about telling the whole story, the full story, and just not picking parts in which make people feel better about their own history. And I just think it's about having all of that. And somebody mentioned about, George Floyd, and, something over there affecting something that happens over here. Well, that happened over there, and the world saw it. And it made people look at what happens here and what happens in their country. So that, you had protests in Brazil and all over the world where people reflected on what inequalities do we have and how do we address it. So that's what happened. It's not that we're taking on what's happening in America, but we saw it and then we reflected, what do we have here and what do we need to fix?
Thank you. I'm not being read on. There's a couple of people talking, murmuring disagreement. And if you don't mind me saying, there's one black person in the room and she just made her point. And the thing about it is, I don't want to be read on and just agree with the woman because she's black. But the real challenge is, if you have a lot of black students in a school or wherever, an awful lot of black students think like that. Where I teach, they all think like that. And the big $6 million question challenge has to be, how do you convince those black students and those white students that what's happening in the history curriculum is problematic? I think we just need to get better. If we think that that's happening, we've got to somehow get even better at being able to win those arguments and convince people that that's the case.
I just wanted to give a real-world example that then might put a question to the panel. My daughter goes to a school that was formerly called Haberdashers Asks Hatcham College.
Yep.
That's a state secondary school, but it's part of a group of schools which include very elite independent schools and some which went into the state sector. They are 350 years old, a little bit older actually. They had a motto called to serve and obey, which kind of stiffened everybody's back when they arrived, but it referred to God and probably monarch. They had a consultation at the end of last year, about a week before we broke up for summer. They removed the name Ask because he was Robert Ask, the haberdasher, who left a big fund for the education of the poor because he had invested in the Royal Africa Company. They removed the motto of to serve and obey because they said that although it referred to God, it could be mistaken to refer to serving a master as a slave. So therefore that should go too. They removed the oil painting of Robert Ask. They couldn't remove the statue because it was listed, so they said he would be repurposed. So I'm thinking like a hat and coat stand or something. I don't know what they've gone for. But that was announced on the first day back of term. Mm. So after you've been through your COVID worries, you know, our children return to school to find, you know, painting missing, you know, all of this change. And, you know, the school is also very woke in what it teaches, and actually some of the other things it wishes to remove are books and replace those with other things. And it wants, it is a largely black community, and to return to this lady, I'd like to say that I'm concerned that actually something was being taken away that the black children might have wanted to see or understand, and that actually, although it's a majority black school, maybe we were removing a piece of history that, even if it was a damaging piece of history, was everyone's right to know and perhaps be concerned about. But my question to the panel is, what is the school just coming up to date, or are they conducting a kind of vandalism of a sort of ephemeral history that tells us who we are, even our bad selves?
Thank you. And panel, we're going to have one more person pick up what you want. And I promise you guys, I do see all your hands, and we will get back. I think we'll get all of you. So Eric Kaufman, who's had his own little taste of the culture wars, I would say, to put it mildly.
Yes, absolutely. We've talked about different ethnic groups' representation in the curriculum. I want to talk about different ideological groups. So let's just take crudely left and right. Stories about the excesses of the Nazis, of the slave trade, Jim Crow, indigenous people in Canada, where I come from, that's sort of, there's a lot of attention paid to that, not only in history, but also in movies and books, et cetera. Those stories are very well known by particularly younger generations. At least I'm not aware of a lot of on the excesses of the left. So the excesses of Stalinism, the killing fields, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, there are very few movies with popular characters that any people know about. And I'm just wondering if in the history curriculum, by essentially not teaching that, we are condemning future generations to repeat the same mistakes of those utopian extremists.
Thank you very much. And, okay, that's good. Guys, let's not just go 1, 2, 3, 4. Just pick up whatever you want, random. Go on, Sean.
Just a couple of points. I will actually be quick. Just on the gentleman in the middle who was talking about the statues and how they were just parroting what they heard in social media, if they did have the full context, would you be fine with the statue coming down then? On the issue just said there about the dangers of leftism, I don't know how you could teach something like Robespierre's Terror or the five-year plans or Mao's campaign and not mention the excesses of those things. Or, I mean, most of us do at GCSE Weimar Germany as our starter because, well, like it or not, Hitler is sort of the main draw for a history GCSE, and there you get to see the extremes of both left and right in sort of the Spartacist uprising and the Cap Putsch. So I don't think it's as big of an issue for me as a teacher. Maybe broaderly, more broad in society, it could be, but certainly as a history teacher, I don't see that as an issue. And then finally, in terms of the sort of archives and libraries and stuff, I literally have no experience of that. I don't work in that sort of thing, so I don't know. That's my response to that. But on the identity politics, I was trying to say that identity politics can be dangerous, not that I was in favor of it.
Who would like to go next?
Okay, well, I'll go, yeah. Just on the question of are we being too sensitive, which I think you raised and links in with your question as well. Some people are, for sure. I think some people do feel sensitive, maybe with reason. Maybe they've got reason to be feeling very sensitive. I'm not going to comment on that. But I think there's a sort of tendency, I think, to there is a tendency to react against the identity politics in a way that just replicates it from the other side. So it's you say X, I say Y. You know, this Churchill was a complete racist scumbag. To those who say no, he was a great patriot. Yeah, and I don't think that really gets us very far. That kind of just carries on the a war. It's not a real war, but a kind of a rather vicious and not very productive discussion at the same level. It's just sort of each side batting for the other. But this is where I think the knowledge side of it is really, really important, because if you're just going to go on taking your criteria for changing the curriculum, whether that's adding things or changing it or taking out, the more that criteria strays away from established disciplinary criteria, the more unstable it becomes, the more open it becomes to activists, to loudest voices out there in society. And then what you get, for example, just to show you what I mean, you know, one, there's a history book out at the moment, again, with from the Justice to History, which is all about, you know, they want to introduce a topic on Native Americans in America, right? And it starts off by the claim, the treatment of Native Americans, and women in particular, was a result of patriarchy and white supremacy. And the rest of the slides and the rest of the material continue to flesh that claim out. And I just want to read you, like I said, a few sentences from an academic book on Iroquois women in Native America. Many aspects of the society will be considered in order to attempt to understand the position of women in Iroquoian society. These include the tasks and activities of the women performed, the control over the choice of a marriage partner and the ability to divorce, the matrilineal inheritance pattern, control over warfare. You get the picture, right? This concrete, actual archive, you know, archive, when it comes back to your thing, the archives thing. There has been damage done, no doubt, and it isn't really commented on. You know, when I was studying for my PhD and I was working in Cambridge archives, the archivist said they were astonished that I was coming back for, like, you know, month after month, because they were used to government policymakers coming in, staying there for like 2 days and just grabbing what they wanted in order to produce a report that supported a political rather than an educational agenda.
Thanks, Alka. Sean and Nicholas, the clock is going to beat us soon. So if you can be relatively brief, I'm going to take a couple of very final ones from the floor.
Okay. I agree about American influence. A very good example is the way in which the term Anglo-Saxon, which is very much part of the history of Angleland, has somehow been denigrated because of its use in the States in a very different context. And as for what happened at Haberdasher's Asp, which I read about in the paper, I don't think vandalism is quite the right word. It's hiding, it's ducking the challenge of the past. It's cowardice, really. I would hope that someone was challenging it, I don't know. The governments and governance point is a very interesting one in the sense it's too big to be dealt with very briefly. I think largely the actual reality of government is ignored. It's seen as a bit dull, and the sort of processes of government. And what I think is that democracy, as an example from history, suffers very badly because students tend to learn a lot about dictatorship. Of one sort or another. They don't really learn, apart from people excluded from the vote. Typically, you know, the suffragette story, but to some extent maybe earlier parliamentary reform bills. But on the actual working of a democracy, the only example tends to be looked at is Weimar Germany, which is not a very happy example. So I think there is an issue there that in a sense we're not really engaging with the nature of governments and the actual operation of a democratic government. And last of all, the point about wanting an inclusive curriculum, that's exactly what I want. It's difficult because history is itself a process to some extent. Every time you select what to include in your account, you're choosing what not to include. And my point about the timetable time comes into this. Yeah. So yes, I would entirely agree. In fact, I couldn't agree more. That is very much what I want to see. But I don't like the way other things therefore get erased for the wrong reasons.
Nicholas.
I'll try and be brief. And I just want to sort of focus on something that sort of emerged without ever really being specifically talked about, apart from you. which is the notion increasingly that sort of history for pupils has to be about them. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. You mentioned a star student of yours. You said it would be nice to see myself. And I don't at all say that that's wrong. I sort of quite understand it. But I have to say it sort of wasn't my personal experience. Now, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, I was the only person in any of the schools I attended with more than a mild suntan, really, or a few freckles. And so I suppose I didn't really expect to see myself reflected anywhere. And that's just a generational difference. That's all that is. But where it led me was to the feeling that I, in a sense, wanted the exact reverse. I wanted to see things that were unlike me, that were different. So I wanted to learn about Incas and Zulus and you know, Iroquois and Cheyenne and the things. I wanted to see what was different. Yeah. And my own, though I entirely understand your student saying, I'd like to see myself at least occasionally. I fully understand it. My only worry about that is that if followed to its logical extreme, you imprison people rather than liberate them.
It's a great point, Nicholas. It's a debate about, do you, you know, is the role of the school and education to take people beyond themselves or affirm them? Right, I'm only going to take people only if they're ridiculously frigging quick. And only speak if you're damned to speak. You people on the platform, you will come back with 30 seconds and it leaves your food for thought. Your last thing to take away about this debate, it's got to be 30 seconds. Yes, I missed you out earlier, the woman at the back.
Don't you think enough books have been written about, like, Winston Churchill and things like that? Enough people have talked about him that we can, like, talk about and use other people's narratives to talk about that time and things that happened around that with, like, creativity and, like, using your brain and also, like, hard work, and you put the work in.
Thank you very much. And, yourself with the old white T-shirt there, the old Battle of Ideas worker.
Yeah, it makes me very distinctive. Just... how do we choose the fundamentals of, say, the GCSE history curriculum? Because I'm pretty sure my fundamentals are very different from yours.
I've got 30 seconds to reply to that.
It's a great question, and Shirley's going to be nice and brief for us.
Yeah, I'll try. I just wanted to a couple of comments about not just what is taught, but how it's taught. And thing about Weimar Germany made me think about a lesson I once saw. I used to spend a lot of time in schools watching lessons. And the pupils, secondary pupils, being asked, looking at various photos of, for example, Nazis with guns and children watching a demonstration of gun. And the lesson was all about how the children felt, about how they would have been, how if they'd been those children in the Second World War, how they would have felt about it. Another classroom, different school, different time, letters to Mr. Hitler telling him what he'd done.
Thank
wrong.
You, Shirley.
You know, so that thank therapeutic you.
Some people call it
feeling.
Empathy, actually. And there might be a space for that in the history. You know, we'll let the panel decide. Yep.
Northern Irish Protestant here.
Chuck your la.
I learned as a child the entirely unproblematic story of the plantation of Ulster and of all those brave men and women who came across and took on the cowardly Irish. I joke, but only partly.
That's true.
That curriculum has been decolonized. Is that not a good thing?
Fantastic. What's your name?
I'll tell you.
He's going to get you.
Where do you live?
Hey, what's your dress? Brilliant point. I really like that. Right. I really like that. That was great. And you know the point that was raised there from yourself about what would you put in the curriculum? We had a departmental meeting on Wednesday afternoon, and the line came down from we have two co-head teachers to tell us, history department, that we have to change our GCSE. We have to find things with more black representation in it. Just an answer to part answer to your question, which is where we are at with the situation. And who wants to go first? Sean?
Yeah. Just sort of on that, the whole idea of changing the names of schools and changing the names of heads of houses and all that, for me, is just a sort of more cowardly tokenism that everybody thinks this all boils down to, rather than actually addressing the reason why people might be annoyed by a certain name or a certain house. What we're doing instead is just going, that's gone. And then other people are terrified by that erasure. So context is key. That's sort of what I'll leave you with.
In Sean's school, my old school, Queens, there are four houses. It's 1,800 kids. And one of the houses is called Drake House. So they've cut out Drake from the names. Alka.
Okay, I think just with your, agree very much with Nicholas on your girl who wants to be reflected. I mean, for me, the question would always be, you want to be reflected as what? You know, I know if I was at school and somebody wanted to reflect me as a brown girl, I would have felt a bit insulted, really. But if they wanted to reflect me as a person who's interested in this X, Y, or Z, you know, I wanted to be Baroness Orcs' Scarlet Pimpernel at one time. That was who I identified with. on too many books, I'm sorry, I have to just, there can never be too many books. There can never, ever be. No matter from crap to fantastic, you need books. What we do need, though, I think, is a better conversation between scholars in history, particularly, and the education profession. Because I think there is a vast range of excellent, I don't know what you call it, global historical scholarship, post-colonial scholarship, which is really interesting. People like Jürgen Osterhammel, you guys will probably know, and who are really like looking afresh at the development of the Enlightenment, at development of capitalism. And I just think it would be so fantastic to use some of that, use some of that stuff to make the history curriculum, you know, come alive in new ways, to speak to, you know, in ways that will be, keep its integrity to scholarship, but also speak more to things have moved on. We live in a different
Thank you, Alka. I'm going to announce this before I take you two in, but everybody, there's end of festival drinks straight after this in the Bishop Partridge Hall, and free drinks. Sean.
I got to keep you from them. Control of the curriculum is, in who decides, it's very complicated because it goes all the way from Secretary of State and Schools Minister through to bodies like exam boards and, of course, the various people within exam boards. Other groups outside that but who have influence, like the Historical Association, but other groups as well. Right the way down to head teachers, deputy heads, heads of department, and sometimes down to the individual teacher in the classroom. We've never had a sort of continental-style, centrally directed curriculum, even after the Kenneth Baker changes. So it is complex, and actually I think that gives opportunities both for the sort of things we've been worried about, but also for people to take some sort of individual responsibility for what is actually taught. And I think that can be a very good thing.
Thanks, Sean. Last but not least, Nicholas.
I don't know that I've got more to say than I've already said, really, though that, again, won't stop me. I may have sounded sort of overtly sort of bellicose and warlike and pessimistic and whatever, but I suppose in the end, I have suddenly discovered in the course of this conversation that I do have a fundamental belief. And it turned out to be quite optimistic. And that's that if history is true and interesting, children will like it. That's it.
Yeah.
Give them a round of applause.